we would have been a much poorer state because the wealth in this state is the oil, and the oil production probably would have been ended by now.
The benefit of the ever-elusive gas line. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, September 19th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District considers changing the name of an elementary school named after an admitted pedophile.
This isn't a problem that went away in 1916. Echoes of sexual abuse are heard still today. It remains a problem in Alaska.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to AlaskaCleanHarbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
For more than 40 years, the state has tried and failed to bring natural gas from Alaska's North Slope to market. In all, there have been at least 10 different versions of the pipeline megaproject, and not one has come close to breaking ground. This week in the series Pipeline Promises, Alaska's Energy Desk is taking a step back to ask some key questions. Will it ever happen? And if so, why is it taking so long? Rasha McChesney is up first with a tour through some of the milestones in the state's love affair with a gas line.
The 70s were a crazy time in Alaska. The state was young, and along came its first infatuation, oil. Prudhoe Bay was discovered in 1968, and it was a good-looking charmer. It was North America's largest oil field by far.
It was a poor state. And this was going to change everything, and it did change everything.
That's Bill White, a former journalist and pipeline historian. Think of him as your high school history teacher, complete with nerdy glasses and a big smile. But his only subject is the gas line.
Are you ready to ride, or
should we? I'm ready.
Okay.
He's taking me on a one-of-a-kind tour of Anchorage, important sites in the state's quest for a gas line. It's kind of like the Love Boat, except we're in my Toyota and no one ends up together at the end. Plus, this tour is mostly office buildings.
The 40-year history of the project is largely a paperwork exercise. There was some field work, but the big decisions were done in offices by people in ties.
Our first stop is the original BP headquarters in Midtown.
Is it back there? No, that's 3201.
BP set up here in the 70s. Hope for a gas line was at its peak. We were in the middle of building an oil pipeline, and the gas line was next. There were three competing proposals, with some familiar names attached. Exxon and TransCanada were on board, so were BP and ARCO, which later became ConocoPhillips. White says it seemed like some line was inevitable.
There was not only hope, but the expectation that it was going to happen.
People were worried the U.S. was running out of natural gas, Congress and the president got involved, but the competing projects ended up in court. By the time a route was picked, the U.S. had found other sources of natural gas, and the project couldn't find financing. But it didn't take long for the state to find another love interest.
It was immediate.
Next stop, downtown, the former headquarters of the Yukon Pacific Corporation. But then we run into one of the hazards of doing a tour with a driver, that's me, who's not from Anchorage.
And so this area where we are in downtown, what did it look like in 81 versus what it looks like now?
We're not downtown.
Okay. Oh, right. All right. Now we're in downtown, right?
Yeah, now we're downtown.
Okay.
And Wally Hickel's hotel.
Former Governor Wally Hickel formed Yukon Pacific in 1983. He planned to ship gas to Asia. For 20 years, this project was Hickel's baby, and it had a lot going for it. Presidential approval, check. Environmental impact statement, check. Permission to ship gas overseas, check. But it was missing two very important things.
What it didn't have is natural gas to sell or natural gas buyers who would buy natural gas.
By the early 2000s, Hickel's project had fizzled. Let's just stop here to think about what would have happened if Alaska had gone all the way with a gas line. The state would be even richer today, right? Wrong.
We would have been a much poorer state because the wealth in this state is the oil, and the oil production probably would have been ended by now.
For 30 years, we've been using the gas, reinjecting it into the ground to produce more oil. And that's a big reason why, for a long time, the North Slope oil companies were not really on board with a gas line project.
The plan B has worked out very well. It has been really a phenomenal success story as a plan B.
And it's not like the gas is disappearing.
You're not losing any of the gas. You're just saving it for later. It's kind of like your IRA.
It's like a retirement plan
it's
for this
like
state.
It's like a retirement plan.
It's a natural gas retirement plan.
But some of Alaska's more recent governors have been itching to cash in that plan. And around 2000, it's starting to look like the state has a chance. Oil production on the North Slope is in a steep decline, natural gas prices have spiked, and companies are starting to plan for the future. And this is where it starts to look a lot like speed dating. Since 2000, five governors have had five different plans. First, Tony Knowles signs a deal that would override state taxes, but it may not have been constitutional. Frank Murkowski negotiates a deal in private with the three major North Slope producers. The only part that makes it through the legislature is a hike on oil taxes. Then Sarah Palin comes in and offers $500 million in state money to sweeten the pot, but the fracking revolution swamps the gas market. So Sean Parnell pivots to Asia, where the Japanese tsunami sent prices soaring, and the state partners with Exxon, BP, and ConocoPhillips.
Well, this is the vortex of the current efforts to do an Alaska gas project.
We're at the Midtown building, where some of the recent players are staying. The Alaska LNG Project headquarters are here. The state arm of the project, the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation, is here. And so is the lead partner, ExxonMobil. Despite moving in together, things aren't going so hot. A new governor, Bill Walker, has taken the wheel. He wants the state to drive. And that's where we end our tour. But there are some lessons from all of this serial pipeline dating. White says the projects have failed for different reasons, but they shared one problem. Alaska's gas line is a really expensive date. The price of natural gas has to stay high to justify that cost, and that just hasn't happened.
You have to be a real gambler to want to do this project.
Will the state find a project to say I do? Bill White thinks yes, but maybe not in his lifetime. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Anchorage, I'm Rasha McChesney.
Love stinks. Love stinks.
In part two of the series tomorrow, we'll look at why Bill Walker is so convinced his current approach to the gas line will finally pay off for the state. For more on the series Pipeline Promises, connect with Alaska's Energy Desk on Facebook. One promise of a gas line is low-cost energy for Alaskans. Although Alaska doesn't have a pipeline to move gas currently, another state entity does and will. The Alaska Railroad will be the first to transport liquefied natural gas by rail, not only in Alaska, but anywhere in the United States. The Alaska Railroad Corporation was granted permission by the Federal Railroad Administration to move LNG last year. And as KYC's Dan Bross reports, testing is slated to start this week.
Alaska Railroad spokesman Tim Sullivan says the corporation plans to begin LNG demonstration shipments September 27th.
Moving LNG from South Central into interior Alaska, into Fairbanks.
Sullivan says LNG containers are on loan to the railroad for testing.
The technology is what they've been using overseas in Japan and other places for a number of years. The LNG ISO containers are easily transportable. They can go on flatbed trucks. They can go on flat cars on trains. And so we'll be moving them that way. We got two of the tanks that were donated by Hitachi AW Cryo out of Vancouver, and we'll be using those for the test project.
Sullivan says eight runs are planned over 4 weeks to assess the potential.
We don't know exactly how big this is going to be or how small it will be, but first we've got to get through the demonstration project to see how efficiently we can do it and what that could mean to us.
The LNG will come from a Cook Inlet Point McKenzie processing plant and be delivered to Fairbanks Natural Gas, FNG, and the North Star Borough's Interior Gas Utility are part of the state's Interior Energy Project. And IGU project manager David Pruzak says he's optimistic about rail transport.
Potential to greatly reduce transportation costs with getting the LNG here.
Prusak says reducing transportation costs is one of the keys to meeting the primary goal of the Interior Energy Project.
The delivery of gas at $15 an MCF to the meter.
That's the equivalent of $2 a gallon heating oil for Fairbanks area customers. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, fighting heroin addiction with funds raised through beer sales.
A lot of programs will substitute one addiction with another, and I think the majority of people would agree that beer is a better addiction than heroin.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
At this hour, Anchorage police are still on the scene of a gun-related incident in Eagle River that started shortly before noon today. According to APD spokesperson Renee Osted, police got a call regarding a man with a gun threatening people inside a residence. A SWAT team is on scene at the Husky Street home. Osted would not comment on the incident because it has not been resolved yet. Several people exited the home at the time the police were called. Police say the gunman knows the other residents of the building. A 17-year-old Juneau boy was killed in an accidental shooting outside a home in the Mountain Woods Circle neighborhood on Saturday morning. The boy was one of four males preparing for a duck hunt, according to Juneau Police Department press release. He was reportedly standing outside of a truck when he tried to pull his shotgun out of the back seat by its barrel. The gun went off and the boy was hit in his torso. The rest of the hunting party was standing outside of the truck during the shooting. Police say they tried to give the victim first aid before first responders arrived. An ambulance took the victim to Bartlett Regional Hospital, where he was pronounced dead. The victim was a student at Thunder Mountain High School. A member of the Fairbanks North Scarborough School Board is asking to change the name of an elementary school. Michael O'Brien says Badger Road Elementary is named for a convicted pedophile. As KYC's Robert Hannon reports, the historical record shows Harry M. Badger admitted to abusing a 10-year-old girl.
Fairbanks School Board Vice President Mike O'Brien says when he first ran for office, several people told him about Harry M. Badger. 100 years ago, the official land recorder for Fairbanks was accused of raping a young girl. O'Brien says at first he had his doubts and dug into the history.
He was a prominent person, so when he was accused of raping a 10-year-old girl when he was 46, it was big news in Fairbanks. Although town came out for a big trial, he immediately admitted to all the charges against him.
O'Brien says Badger's defense attorney sought out a French expert who explained pedophilia was a mental disorder that couldn't be helped. The prosecutor was Badger's friend who didn't want to see him go to jail. O'Brien says Judge Charles Bunnell, future president of the Alaska Agricultural College and School of Mines, handed down a sentence of 6 months in jail.
And folks in Fairbanks were outraged. There were editorials in the newspaper. In fact, another man, an Alaska Native man, sentenced at the same time for the same crime, got a sentence of 10 years in jail.
O'Brien says once Badger served his time, he was back in Fairbanks and returned to being a prominent and respected member of the community. Columnist and author Dermot Cole has written several books on Fairbanks. He says in 1983, when the school board took up naming the new elementary school after Badger, someone brought his history to its attention.
The board decided rather than change the idea of naming the school after Badger, they would name the school after Badger Road, which
always struck me as the distinction without a difference because the road is named for Harry Badger.
Now board member Mike O'Brien says it's time to change the name. Whatever virtues Badger may have had, he says it's inappropriate to have a convicted pedophile's name on an elementary school.
Obviously, this isn't a problem that went away in 1916. Echoes of sexual abuse are heard still today. It remains a problem in Alaska. So it's a conversation, I think, that's worth having.
The school board will take up O'Brien's suggestion at its work session tonight. His research is online at the school district's website. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
A Juneau organization that fights heroin abuse will take a quarter of the money raised during the city's annual Brew Fest. Its participation raised the question, is it appropriate for an anti-heroin group to take donations from a beer festival, especially considering Alaska's high rates of alcoholism? KTOO's Quentin Chandler looked for the answer at Juneau's fifth annual Capital Brew Fest.
The party is on at the Juneau Rotary's Capital Brew Fest. There's a stage, live music, and a large room packed with people drinking from short glasses of beer. The organization Juneau Stop Heroin Start Talking is passing out koozies that say beer and bacon are 100% better for you than heroin. Adam Beekler isn't too concerned.
It's weird, but a lot of programs will substitute one addiction with another, and I think the majority of people would agree that beer is a better addiction than heroin.
Each year, the Juneau Rotary partners with another organization to help throw the Brewfest. The partner gets 25% of the money the festival raises. Rotary officials say historically the event raises about $25,000. But should Michelle Morgan's organization, Juneau Stop Heroin, Start Talking, take that money? The CDC has reported Alaska has one of the highest rates of binge drinking in the country. The state reported in 2010 Alaska had the highest rate of fetal alcohol syndrome. Morgan agrees that alcohol can be dangerous, but says the Brewfest is a legal event and it gives her a chance to spread her message.
I did the Bacon Fest and we did the same thing. Bacon is 100% better for you than heroin. Anything is better for you than heroin. I mean, it can kill you with one mistake.
She says she will go to any event to spread awareness and try to save the next generation from the dangers of heroin. Morgan says the money she gets from the Rotary will help fund her awareness campaign. It will also help in a new venture. She and a woman whose son died from heroin abuse are planning to take the message into Juneau's schools. Morgan wants to talk about the state's report that Southeast Alaska saw a near 500% increase in hepatitis C cases in 5 years. The report links the increase to injection drug use. In Juneau, I'm Quentin Chandler.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Arctic is wild, remote, and untouched. See how contemporary artists challenge the mythical ideal of the North in the Anchorage Museum exhibition, View from Up Here, the Arctic at the Center of the World, on view through October the 2nd. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Museum. If you're looking for business opportunities in the government marketplace, you'll want to know about the Alaska Procurement Technical Assistance Center. Alaska PTAC helps businesses navigate the challenging process of the federal, state, and local government procurement cycles with offices in Anchorage and Fairbanks and delivers services statewide. More information at ptacalaska.org. This message brought to you by Alaska PTAC.
Residents of a tiny Kenai Peninsula subdivision near Anchor Point thought they had a little slice of peace and quiet. But a tract of homestead land to the south held an oil test well, and now it's home to 38 acres containing an active oil well, processing train, workers' camp, and a five-story rig that's about to start drilling 30 more wells. KBBI's Jenny Nyman has more.
When Herf Keith retired from the Alaska Railroad in Anchorage in 2007, he wanted a change of pace. Somewhere he could fish, enjoy the view, and relax. He found the perfect spot in a tiny subdivision on the bluff above Cook Inlet, 7 miles north of Anchor Point, where he lives with his girlfriend, Colette Buick.
There's our moose out there, and a cow and the calves.
Wow.
Yeah. So it doesn't bother them right now.
There's only one other full-time neighbor. The rest of the handful of houses are vacation properties. To the south is the Hansen Homestead, which was mostly vacant when Keith built his house, except for an old test well drilled by ConocoPhillips in 2001. Keith didn't worry much about it. One capped well, abandoned for years. What's the worst that could happen? Well, this. The site is now the centerpiece of Blue Crest Energy, an independent oil company based in Fort Worth, Texas, which is constructing a full-blown oil drilling and production operation on the 38-acre pad.
And it's just nonstop. It's, you know, they've been building this facility. There's a 52-room hotel next door now. It's less than 1,000 feet from my property to their property. That's close.
Unbeknownst to Keith, Bluecrest confirmed a sizable reservoir of high-quality crude and natural gas out below Cook Inlet. Construction on the pad began in September 2015, with plans to directionally drill for oil from onshore. The company expects the project to last 30 years. Bluecrest reached out to area residents early on. It's not the company's preference to set up shop in a residential area. Representatives keep in touch with neighbors and have held several community meetings to give project updates, answer questions, and address concerns. Larry Burgess, Health, Safety, and Environmental Manager, has been the community liaison for Bluecrest. He's sitting in the cafeteria while kitchen staff is cleaning up after lunch.
Now, they could see the well when they moved in over there. They could see this existing well. And unfortunately, they thought that this would never occur, and now it has. I mean, I feel for them. I mean, I would hate it if I was them.
Bluecrest has made efforts to mitigate its impact on the neighborhood. 10,000 gallons of water a day are trucked in for use in the camp. Rather than drilling a water well in the local aquifer, Bluecrest built a 20-foot earthen berm around the site to dampen the noise, and the company schedules pipe deliveries during the daytime so the inevitable clanging and banging doesn't disrupt sleep. But Burgess acknowledges mitigation can only go so far.
But, you know, those little things, they help. They know we're doing what we can, but we're not going to shut this thing in and stop, you know, the millions of dollars that have been spent here. But we're not going to ignore them either.
Burgess gave me a tour of the facility in late June. It was a calm day at the site. The well was shut in and the natural gas compressors were off. The gas flare was just a pilot light.
It's pretty quiet right now. But it can be noisy, though.
The compressors are one of the noisiest things on the pad, even with hospital-grade mufflers installed. Burgess says Bluecrest paid to have a sound survey done to measure noise levels on and around the pad. Even with the compressors running full speed, the highest decibel reading on top of the berm was 61.5, which is about as loud as a conversation. But Burgess says the noise will get worse when the new rig starts drilling, which should start in mid-October.
Without question. And I have not pulled any punches with them. I've told them straight up, this is going to get worse.
Herf Keith doesn't want to be around to hear it.
I'm 66 years old. I put everything in my life savings into this place. I got a good retirement, and I do not want to sit here to this noise factor for the next 30 years.
He says he can't imagine who would want to buy his house now, but he plans to list it for sale anyway. I'm Jenny Nyman.
More than a month after construction began on the controversial stretch of the Dakota Access Pipeline, the front line of the fight is filled with faces from Alaska to Florida. As Inside Energy's Amy Sisk reports, for many camped on the North Dakota prairie, the fight feels familiar.
It's a short walk from the central fire where people converge to hear prayer and song to the place where the Sami family set up camp.
My dad brought a good tent.
That's Tiwani Sami. He points inside to their two beds, some boots, a space heater. Outside, it's a sea of people living just like them along the confluence of the Cannonball and Missouri rivers. They're here for one reason, the water. Less than a mile north is the epicenter of the fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline. That's the spot where the line, capable of carrying half of North Dakota's daily oil production, would cross under the Missouri River, if construction is ever completed. Tawani and his dad, Quiltman, traveled 1,300 miles from Oregon to join the Standing Rock Sioux tribe in its fight to stop that construction. Tribal members here are concerned sacred sites have already been destroyed and a potential spill could poison the drinking water on the reservation downstream.
Everything needs that water. Everything, all life.
Indigenous people have a long history opposing energy development and infrastructure projects they say threaten their environment. Those fights, including the one today, raise questions about sovereignty, about tribes' rights to have a say in managing their land. Brian Cladisby is president of the National Congress of American Indians, a Washington, D.C.-based advocacy group for tribes' rights.
Just about every tribe has horror stories of the government allowing companies and corporations to at will destroy these sacred sites.
From environmental problems in Alaska after the Exxon Valdez oil spill to coal mining on ancestral land, these stories are shared widely at the camps here in North Dakota. Johanna Holy Elkface sits near the central fire listening to music. She was born here on Standing Rock, but now lives in Denver. She tells me the story about her sister who lives on the Navajo Reservation in the southwestern United States.
Dairy water looks horrible, though. It's like yellow clay.
She's referring to the Gold King mine spill. Contractors working at the abandoned mine in Colorado last year unintentionally caused 3 million gallons of wastewater to leak into the nearby river, which then flowed through New Mexico and Utah. Last month, the Navajo Nation sued the Environmental Protection Agency over its response to the disaster. Cyrus Norcross of the Navajo Nation is used to seeing tribes fight and ultimately lose. But here, the Dakota Access protest...
And it kept getting bigger and bigger, and next thing you know, I was like, I think these guys might actually win.
Earlier this month, three federal agencies announced they would block construction of the pipeline for now at the Missouri River crossing while re-examining their permitting decisions. There's talk that this is a turning point for indigenous people. Here's Cladisby with the National Congress of American Indians.
We are showing the world that this is not going to be business as usual going forward.
The Dakota Access Pipeline developer, Energy Transfer Partners, said in a statement that concerns about the pipeline's impact on the local water supply are unfounded and that it was designed with, quote, tremendous safety factors. Construction on the 1,200-mile project is 60% complete. For Inside Energy, I'm Amy Sisk.
Inside Energy is a public media collaboration focused on America's energy issues. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Rasha McChesney and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Dan Bross and Robert Hannon in Fairbanks, Quentin Chandler in Juneau, Jenny Nyman in Kenai, and Amy Sisk in North Dakota. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Eric Bork is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
The University of Alaska Southeast specializes in you. UAS is a learning community where your professors are mentors and friends on campus and online. UAS.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.